Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map. And we're back with some talking about strange shows that we have done.
This little episode is about strange incidents, strange gigs, yes, we may have encountered, strange things we may have encountered in strange gigs.
Gigs that you and I have played, and that they were weird, you know.
One jumps to mind. I've given this no forethought, so I make no excuses or no disclaimers.
Okay.
We, on a very early Susie and the Banshees tour of the United States, and this particular gig was down in Florida.
Know it well.
Okay, and we'd gone out, and I think we were heading out on that road that goes down through the Keys. And it was
nighttime.
We couldn't see anything. That's the thing. It was dark. And it was dark, and we felt there's nothing going to come of this trip. We're just going down this dark road with what looked like lakes and water either side. And there's a light. There's a light in a kind of a shack. And we entered into the realm of the gig for the evening.
Where was it supposed to be? Was it supposed to be in Key West then, or somewhere like that?
To this day, I don't know. But the local promoter was also the local barman and the local restaurant and the local house. And the local,
wow.
Our dressing room was his house. And then you walk across the bayou or something. And I remember Peter Snarler Barnes, our lighting designer.
Yes,
he's still around. But Pete came up to us and said, "Do you want to see the lighting desk?" And we're going, "You got a lighting desk?" He said, "Yeah, do you want to see it?" He said, "Go on then, where is it?" And he kind of pulled his hands from around his back and held up a little box with two little round knobs on it and went, this one is off and this one is fade. And then he said, "Do you want to see the follow spot?" He said, "Yeah, does it get better?" He went, "Not really." And he presented Susie with a hand torch.
Right, flashlight. She had flashlight.
Thanks for thanks for the translation.
I do that all the time, just naturally.
Presented with a flashlight. Now, the gig was, we're coming up to, we're not far off Halloween.
Right.
As we speak, it was Halloween. Very apt.
Yeah.
So I don't think many people had heard that we were in town, because we were not. Right. We were down in the middle of nowhere,
right?
With crocodiles and alligators, probably not crocs, but probably
alligators. Yes.
And it was a chicken in the basket type of place. There wasn't a lot of chicken. There were not a lot of baskets, and there were not a lot of people. But Susie put on a great show. with the handheld spotlight.
I'd pay good money to see that. I hope there's videos of that somewhere.
I bet there aren't, but I'm sure somebody's got one somewhere. The one person that was there, we could have been pre-video. We could have easily been down there. But, you know, that kind of thing where you put the flashlight underneath your chin and you kind of
That makes you look really scary.
Yeah, and probably, you know, we played the best show of our lives. Well, you always do when there's nobody there.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's funny you should say that because I remember playing a Halloween gig in Denver. And, you know, being as we're from, you know, England, back then we had no idea what Halloween was about. And we pulled into town and we're just sort of driving around in a rented car looking at the place. And we stop at some traffic lights. And all of a sudden, you know, Fred Munster and assorted, you know, ghouls and demons come out from around the corner and proceed to spray the whole car with silly string as we're sitting in the car. We freaked out. We were like, what the hell is going on? We got no idea, you know, and the local promoter told us, oh, yeah, it's Halloween. And that night, the Cure's audience was even more goth than usual, you know, because everybody was in their Halloween costumes as well. So it was kind of interesting, but that was our introduction to Halloween in America.
I had a similar experience in New York City. We went out downtown, wherever we were staying, probably at the Gramercy Parkway.
Right.
But this would be like 1983, 1982, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
When New York City was a bit worse for wear. Fires in buildings were like just de facto. There was like obviously a lot of insurance scamming going on. Let's set fire to the building, get some money. And the fire brigade, you know, the fire chiefs were busy, especially around Halloween. But when the fire truck went by, you know, those big, I mean, we'd never seen anything like it. They're huge with the horns blaring and the lights flashing. Right. And all the fire guys had like, you know, tomahawks and headdresses kind of.
Wow.
It was just everybody was in character on the fire truck.
Oh dear.
And racing to a fire probably somewhere in the, you know.
Wow.
But it was it kind of thought, okay, we've arrived, you know, New York, skyscrapers, fire.
Everything with graffiti as well, I remember back then. Going to the other side of the pond and a little further, I'm going to recall it because your gig out in the middle of nowhere in the Keys kind of reminded me of this. We did a festival in the very northern part of Europe in Finland, in Turku. And it was sort of, I don't know, it was kind of a lake nearby and it was very misty. But the thing that was the strangest about this whole festival was it never got dark because we were that far north that, you know, we went on stage at about 11 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock, something like that, and it was still sunshine outside, you know, and at about midnight, you know, the sun sort of dipped a little bit below the horizon and then came back up again, and by 3 in the morning, it was fully light again, you know, and that was very strange, sort of doing the whole show, but it being very late, but actually very light. You know, it was kind of
this is worse than jet lag, isn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean you have to have those total blackout curtains in your hotel room, otherwise you'll never go to sleep. You'll just sort of wake up, you know, at 4 in. I think apparently a lot of people do get up at about 3 in the morning there at that time of year and just go and play golf or something because they can, you know. But it was very strange.
Yeah, I wouldn't be playing golf in Turku. I wouldn't be playing golf anywhere, actually. I do remember going back across the pond. I mean, that's not really a gig, but okay, I'll just tell you anyway. I think we arrived in Mesa, Phoenix.
Oh, right. Arizona, yeah.
Is it Arizona? Okay. Yeah. And it's like, I think, and the strangest thing was, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning and the sun was already up, 5 maybe. Right. And the town was alive. Everything was happening. There were people on the streets because I think we were with Love and Rockets at the time. I can't remember why. I think Love and Rockets were with us. And I do remember by about 11 o'clock, people started to go home. You know, it got quiet. And we had decided it's time to get up. and go for a dip in the pool. And so we think we'll have breakfast by the pool, and we kind of get, you know, walk out of our little poolside kind of motel room with a sliding door, and proceeded to burn the skin off the bottom of your feet.
Yes, I've had that feeling in Texas the first time I lay down on a lounger by the pool and stupidly didn't take my shoes out there. And as it got hotter and hotter, I then put my feet down the side and had to run as fast as I could to jump in the pool.
Yeah. British boys abroad.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, should we get back to the gigs, the strange gigs? I do remember a strange gig, and it coincided with around the same time. It would be coinciding with the photo shoot for the first Creatures recording, the infamous shower scene photo session. Yes. It was in the Newcastle City Centre Hotel.
Okay.
And if my memory serves me well, wheels on fire. There was a kind of a matinee afternoon show put on in the hotel ballroom, for want of a better word. But with all the Banshees gear, half the back line, half the crew, small, like, you know, 1 foot high stage.
Right.
The audience comprised of children who were, I think they were either special needs children.
Okay.
Who don't normally get into gigs. And so there's a lot of hyperactivity and a lot of whatever you're supposed to do in this situation, we're not going to do it, you know.
Right.
And we're just playing a set of Susan the Banshees' greatest hits. Not that we had that, you know, but we just threw together all the singles we could muster in about half an hour. Right. And there was just one guy, like a little guy, and it was just he was intent on getting his hand up Susie's skirt or leg or something, you know, but he was like just full of energy and beams, and nobody could hold him back. And of course, you know, you can't say anything because he's a little kid, you know.
Yeah,
but he's obviously got this thing going on inside. He's going like, "Wow, I'm going to have that." It was just it was just the funniest, and strangely charged atmosphere of wild abandon, you know, but like maybe it's like hysteria, that fan hysteria.
Yeah,
I bet you can relate to the thing that just flew through my mind then was almost the opposite, the calm before the hysteria. Where am I talking about?
Oh, you're talking about Japan, I think.
There's absolutely
in Japan. Yes,
yeah, so aren't they the strangest shows?
Yeah, we played our first tour of Japan, and you know, it is, as a traveling musician, I think one of the most different experiences you can have on the planet, because it doesn't resemble a show anywhere else on the planet. I mean, you know, you play in Europe and you play in North America, and even to a certain extent South America, you play in Australia, and pretty much, you know, audiences are kind of the same, you know. Yeah. There's some local differences, but their reactions are pretty much similar.
Like, you can hear the audience, can't you? You can hear
You can hear the audience, and they make their pleasure or displeasure known quite vocally, and you know, it's easy to judge if you've been in front of that kind of audience all your career, to judge how the show's going. Not the case in Japan, because mm-hmm. we played in Japan. I think we're playing some very large hall, like, you know, 5,000 people or whatever. You would not know on our first show, you would not know there was anybody out there. Mm-mm. Because we were listening from the dressing room and we couldn't hear anything, you know, and we walked out on stage and everybody was there. Everybody was very politely looking forward at the stage. And we played our first song to complete silence, you know, 5,000 people completely silent. And then at the end of the song, everybody got up very quickly, clapped, and then sat down again.
Oh.
And was quiet again.
Oh,
and
wow.
So, you know, we all looked at each other like, are we doing something wrong? Is there something that we don't know? And some of those shows, you know, if it was a place in Europe or a place in America, there would be people coming out of their seats in the auditorium wanting to dance or, you know, do something in the middle of the corridors. And, you know, they might get a little pushback from the local security, but in the end, you know, most people are standing up and standing in the aisles. Not so in that concert in Japan. They were they had little gates halfway down the gangways into the audience of Freudian slip there.
Yeah, so that would certainly keep your average audience quiet, wouldn't he?
Yeah, it would. And a little man standing at each one of these things, or a bigger man, and nobody was going to go past him without the requisite pass, you know. So it was all very, very super uber polite. And it took us halfway through the set to kind of get used to the fact that actually, no, they really did like us and they liked what we were doing. This was the way they expressed it. So once we realized that, it's fine, you know.
I was unnerved because it was quieter than our rehearsal room.
Yeah.
I think this is weird. This is weird. But what happens at the end of the show when you play your last song? Do you get the same? Was it the same for you?
I'm trying to remember. Yeah, I'm pretty certain it was kind of, you know, insanity at that point and everything went crazy. But, you know, it was a completely different way of, it was a very respectful way, I think, of listening to what you're doing, you know. So that's good. I mean, because I've seen some gigs, you know, which maybe I've gone to later on, and I watch people in front of me chatting away to their friends as very quiet passage in the song or whatever. And, yeah, I get a little irked by behavior.
Do you mean the disrespect of the quiet passage?
Yes.
I mean, but as former punks, you know.
Yeah. Now we're older punks.
No, we would scoff at the band that expected us to be quiet.
Yeah, right. Well, we were never quiet, you know, on stage. So it was like
I do recall, you know. Whether it be Tokyo or Kyoto or Osaka, wherever it was very early on in first time. See, again, 82 is my recollection.
Right.
And it was like Beatlemania outside, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Every time you came down into the reception area of the hotel, the Prince Tokyo Tower, wherever it was, and the elevator door would open and there'd be like a sea of like heads going like screaming or...
Yeah.
Thrusting something for you to sign, and you go like, "I just want to go get my breakfast, please. Just leave me alone." And you're thinking, "We're not even Duran Duran, you know. Come on, Simon's not here."
And we had a little security team with us, and we would go. I remember, you know, that sort of. You know, it's another different way of being. Like, we would pull up to the hotel. And there would be literally about 5 meters, 5 yards between the door of the bus and the hotel entrance. And the security team who would travel on the bus with us would say, "You have to stay here. We're going to set things up." And we'd look out and we could see nobody down the street, nobody anywhere, you know. And it's like literally like a matter of, you know, 10 seconds to get in the hotel. And they'd get out and they'd pull out these big metal barriers and put them between the bus and the 10 you know seconds away from the front of the hotel. And then when they secured all that, they'd come back on and they'd go, "Okay, now you can come and get into the hotel." And we'd step out of the bus. The first step out of the bus, suddenly hundreds of people would appear from around the corners of the street. They'd been hiding in doorways and stuff. And we were kind of mobbed. And it was very strange feeling. And we took the train, like the bullet train, to Osaka and from Tokyo. And we were on the train and... When we got on the platform to get onto the train, suddenly there was all these people that looked suspiciously like they might be Cure fans, and they all got on the train, like hundreds of them, on several compartments down. And we didn't see them all the time, but they were on the train with us and travelled all the way down there. It was
what a brilliant idea! You could just take your audience with you.
Yeah. Yeah,
everybody exactly. Out the gig, into the van, transport everybody to the station, say, "See you in the next city."
Yeah. Q Curious Creatures is created and presented by Vol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Spare.
Social media, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
I love saying www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com. And you can reach us on Instagram, Facebook, at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter, at Cure Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit DoubleElvis.com or follow at DoubleElvis on Instagram and at DoubleElvisFM on Twitter. Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2021.